I'd appreciate it if the group discussion leaders or those who have, whoever, or the recorders who've recorded questions, kind of waded out into what the group identified as something they wanted to ask, and if we can sort of let them have a chance to roll first, I think that would answer many questions because there will be some similarity from group to group. I would ask you please to come up to the two microphones to make it easier for us to record things on the tape recorder and also in order to be heard. So whoever would like to proceed, please proceed.
I have a question I'd like to direct to Dr. Pearson, who I believe is representing YTG here. I don't know what kind of a slip that is. Mr. Ken Kane has outlined for us how the Indian people have decided to decentralize their government process, to educate their people in land claims issues with workshops, and to try to bring the power in negotiations to their people. I'd like to ask Dr. Pearson if the YTG is planning to do any of this, that is, to bring awareness of land claims process to the white Yukoners, to decentralize their government, and to solicit input from them. And there's a supplementary question. Since CYI has admitted they don't have a mandate to sign for their people before asking them, I was wondering if the YTG thinks it has any mandate to speak for white Yukoners, all Yukoners, or any Yukoners, without going to them for their input. Thank you.
Well, that was a multifaceted question, you've got to admit. And probably we should be discussing it in some form of constitutional development, which is not, I quote, not part of the land claim issue. The territorial government feels that it has a mandate, a definite mandate, under the terms of the Yukon Act, under the constitution of that. The members of the Territorial Council or Legislative Assembly represent the people of the Yukon. And as you well know, from that Legislative Assembly, there are three members of the Assembly that are chosen to sit on the Executive Committee. And the mandate is the democratic mandate of the power of the vote. They have the authority to determine how funds shall be spent, what programs shall be initiated, what type of thing could be developed for people, and I think through that process they also have the right to agree or disagree with various issues that are raised at the Planning Council for settlement of a land claim. I think that the traditional land claim, which involves land and money, is really between the Indian people and the federal government with whom they have an understanding or an agreement to settle. Where the territorial government is concerned, and I'm sure where all of the people of the Yukon are concerned, is what sort of management process will be put into place to represent adequately the views of the people of the Yukon. Those lands that may be vested from the Crown to the Indian people, what will the relationship of management regimes on those lands be to lands under control of the territorial government? And similarly with regard to lands that remain under the control of the federal government. I can't answer those questions at this time. I don't think anybody can. I think we are resolved that we don't want to see happen in the Yukon what has happened in Alaska, where you have a checkerboard situation and almost an impossible situation with regard to management of the resources, the renewable resources and the non-renewable resources of that state. I'm sure nobody wants that to happen in the Yukon, and therefore those are the areas where the territorial government is concentrating its attention. What sort of regime will be established after a land claim settlement? What sort of management processes will be in place? And it's evolving all the time, as you well know. So I'm afraid I can't answer any more of your question than that.
Tonight we heard the Mr. Greiba comment on the federal policy to assimilation. The group would like to know what the YTG position is regarding the concept of assimilation.
Assimilation is a poorly understood word. I don't know what your concept of assimilation is, but I assume it's a traditional one of loss of minority rights by being overruled or overcome by a majority society. Now, we do not believe that that is what should happen in the Yukon. I said earlier that we look forward to the Indian people participating and contributing and working together with the other Yukoners to provide and to produce a new society and new goals and objectives for the Yukon. And there are many people who will say, well, that's assimilation. But I don't believe it is. I think it is not assimilation. It's an integrated system and the only one that will work in the Yukon.
Okay. The second part of that, in deriving a definition of assimilation and taking on from where you carried off about your belief as to what is or is not assimilation, how has the YTG derived their definition of assimilation? Has that been in a cooperative process with the Council of Yukon Indians? Or has it been done outside of that?
It has been done. The goals and objectives of a land claim have been developed within the planning process, and the one government structure system, a system of cooperation and participation is a product of the planning process.
So you're saying that the CYI agrees with what you just gave as a definition of assimilation?
I would rather have the CYI speak for themselves on that.
What can the YTG speak on then? We spent considerable time on discussing, and we agree with you that there is some misunderstanding regarding the concept of assimilation, and I don't know if you've really answered that, but I'll move on to the next question. We've also been told tonight that the land claims will have a broader impact, I guess economically and socially, on the Yukon than will the pipeline. What is the relationship between the two schedules of the pipeline and of the land claims? I'll address that to Dr. Pearson. Well, I'll address it to the
perhaps
get the federal right.
I'd like to lead off on that. Give Art a chance.
Well, I think it's a perfectly valid question in terms of what is the relationship. Clearly, the pipeline project is a very major event in the history of the Yukon and of Canada. I think, though, that it's fair to say, if I understand your question correctly, that while that very major project is a factor, it is only one factor. The long-term goal of the cooperative planning process is to resolve something much broader than a transaction for land or money has been said, and it's something much broader than just taking care of a sort of a one-shot heavy impact project such as a pipeline. What the land claims resolution process is after is the development of a system, of a means for Yukoners, whoever they might be, to cooperatively continue to be Yukoners, and particularly the Indian people who are Yukoners, to have some fair chance of redressing some of the imbalances that have faced them as residents in their own land. Now, the reasons for that are many, but they are all comprised of various impacts, such as the gold rush, such as the development of the Alaska Highway, and now we have a pipeline and the Ajax Power Project, and those things will continue. But I think the importance that there is attached to resolving the land claim embraces the capacity of the Indian people as a consequence of the settlement of that claim to handle those various impacts in such a way that they, along with their fellow Yukoners who are not Indians, can continue to enjoy this territory to the maximum extent possible.
Okay. Just to clarify, are you saying then that there'll be a land claims settlement before there'll be a pipeline?
I think
is that the federal position?
The federal position has been clear from the outset. You will recall that I referred to the entire process as a sequential process. Certain elements of the claim have already or will be very shortly resolved, and I use eligibility as an example. Could well be that several of the other elements can be fully resolved. But you have to keep in perspective, for example, one of the goals is participation more fully in the social and economic and political life of the Yukon. Well, who's to say when that will be fully implemented? That may take a generation. And we're not so naive as to expect that some of these very fundamental changes that face the Indian people will occur overnight. It's not an instant-on situation. So it's very difficult to be absolute as to when implementation per se is complete. The major things, the selection of land, the payment of some kind of cash compensation, could conceivably, at least in part, be implemented or maybe fully implemented. Implemented before or just about the time that the pipeline project begins.
Art, would you like to comment on this question?
Well, the only thing that is really clear is that construction of a pipeline will start on January the 1st, 1981. And so it's the resolve of the participants at the Planning Council, I guess, whether the land claim is settled and what parts of it are settled and implemented before that time. Indeed, the pipeline, I guess, has provided a certain incentive, a certain purpose, and a time frame within which I think everybody would like to work. We have to balance against that hasty decisions that may not be properly thought through and may not be properly implemented. It's a very difficult position to be in, I'm sure, but I think, like too many things, a land claim or research or other things would carry on as long as one would let it to. And when we've got goals and we've got timetables to follow, I somehow think we may get to the point a little more rapidly and a little more efficiently than we would if those goals did not exist.
Okay. I don't want to be rude. One of the words that cropped up in our group was rhetoric. We've heard tonight that the priority of the federal government is the settlement is satisfactory settlement of the land claims. Is that the top priority of the YTG as well, or is the top priority a pipeline, or are there two? Is there a contradiction that can be two priorities?
Well, I think that we have many priorities, and those are two of them, two high on the list. The YTG are ready and prepared to sit at any time at the Planning Council to resolve the land claim. I suggest to you that the Indian people have to feel that they wish to resolve the claim and resolve it now, and I believe they do, and I think that we will be sitting down in a more regular fashion than we have in the past to discuss the various elements and try to successfully reach a resolution of this land claim.
I'm wondering if Ken has any comments on that.
In regards to pipelines before land claims, well, it is still a position of the General Assembly for CYI that we resolve and settle our land claims before any pipelines or major development happens. Because what we're talking about, I guess, is we're talking about land, and when you talk about land and Indians, you it's pretty hard to separate land from our way of life. I mean, the reason we say that is not because we're anti-development or opposed to development. It's just that we see that as the opening of major development in the Yukon. And what we're saying, I guess, is that certain things have to be set in place before you can start all this development up here. And one of them, I guess, the big question is land. I mean, we have to settle that first before you can start building anything over it.
Okay. I've just got two not so involved questions. One, the financing of the parties that are involved in the negotiation. There's some question as to where the money comes for the people, for the salaries or whatever, for the administration.
Wally, I think that's one for you.
Yes, that's a valid question. We have three parties. The Yukon Territorial Government is using its own resources to participate in the process, as is the federal government. Council for Yukon Indians has entered into an agreements with the federal government, where under which funds are made available to the CYI for their operations on a contractual basis as a charge against proceeds of the claim. So the Indian people of the Yukon are using funds that are provided currently from the public purse, but which are in fact, I guess you could interpret as a bit of an advance payment on the payment that will eventually be made in cash for the claim.
Okay.
One more.
Okay, last one. Question was, how far have land claims progressed so far with specific regards to any land transactions, resources, and any other elements of the claim? I guess, what is the current status?
Question is going to be partly answered by the next two sessions. Basically, the topic of what the future holds, the topic of the next two sessions. If either of you would care to comment, go right ahead.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I think it's fair to say that the claims process has gone to this point that without dealing specifically with quantum and so on of land and money and so on, the settlement model, which is a Planning Council's document number 4, has been put forward. The next step, as CYI have indicated recently on their part, and certainly the government has on its part, is trying independently for discussion at the Planning Council table to prepare our respective draft agreements in principle. These would be agreements in principle on the various elements of the claim, not in very specific terms, perhaps. So I guess you could say that within the next few very visible months, we're hopeful that we can have an agreement in principle in place, which will deal in varying detail with some of the elements. Such things as the selection of land, etc., have not been resolved, and we fully appreciate the very immense task facing Council for Yukon Indians and their constituency in determining the goals they have for the lands which are so important to them and how we might reach those goals. So while we may not be totally specific on all of the elements, I think you can safely expect within a reasonable length of time to see an agreement in principle which will give everyone a pretty good indicator of where we're at.
Get any more recorders here? A gentleman, a few words, Mr. Robert Sharp.
Okay, the price for that card. We have a few questions from our group that haven't yet been covered. The first to Mr. Kane. One of the members in our groups indicated that he had spoken with people in Yukon Indian communities that had complained that even at the band administration level, as of July 77, they were not being fully informed. Has this changed since that time?
Yes, I think, like I said, there's a whole process, natural progression that evolved the last year and a half that I've been with CYI, going back to the first mandate that we got when we first reorganized was to educate, raise a level of awareness of our people in the communities. I think since July, what we've done is we've put a number of things in place. Like number one was like we've add what we call regional coordinators to work more closely with the contact in the communities. And the constitution was changed to involve the communities more in the selection of the executive at the, for CYI. And I think the most interesting thing that came out of there was this community council that was just recently formed, like in Mayo, in Pelly, and also in Carmax and Haines Junction. And out of that community council grew negotiators for each area that would add a little more, more and more people, that, you know, through this, getting them involved, like through the land claims office and through the community council and negotiator. I think I have to say that, and also just looking at this election, you know, we know for sure, you know, over 35% of Yukon Indians over 16 know about land claims. As a result of this election, things like that. I think what has happened is, like, I think when you talk about awareness and what are you really talking about, I guess, is this society, I mean, how the society functions. I think when you look at, I guess it's taken, what, 100 years for Canada to be here. And I think in 1968 was the first time the Yukon Indians ever had a voice or an organization to speak for. So I think in 9 years, not only from 77, I think we've made, you know, how do you make 9 years into 100, you know what I mean? I think we've come a long ways.
By and large, the members of our group, while they weren't sure about the effectiveness of the process that the CYI has embarked on to inform people in communities throughout the Yukon, felt that there was a corresponding lack of such a program on the YTG's part. And that the advantages of such a program that are being felt by Indian people throughout the Yukon because of the CYI program could possibly, a comparable program established by the YTG could benefit those people. Is it the YTG's intention to initiate such a program?
Well, the YTG participates at the Planning Council to consider positions, but the positions are brought there, let's see, the claim is brought by the Indian people. And unless I misunderstand the process at the present time, the Indian people are not going to the communities to explain to them what land they will get or what money they will get, but they're trying to get the people to tell them what they should bring in turn to the Planning Council as the Indian position. And where the Yukon people all will be involved, as I see it, is after we have gone through the Planning Council process of various issues, these documents. We'll say that we get on to, we'll say wildlife management or resource management, and we discuss the options in there, and we bring forward a paper which covers a wide range of options, and perhaps we will all agree on the best solution to that particular management concept. Perhaps we won't, but those options that flow from the Planning Council itself will go to the people of the Yukon for dialogue and for discussion. Those are not decisions. Those are not irrevocable. These documents are all for discussion, and these are the discussion papers that we feel will flow to the people of the Yukon.
It's the mechanism of flow, how those documents become publicly known and discussed and understood by the people of the Yukon that is the issue I'm questioning. Is there an attempt being made by the Yukon Territorial Government to ensure that this type of information is understood and is thought through and discussed and aired among both Indian and non-Indian people in the territory?
Well, at the present time, the Standing Committee on Yukon Native Land Claims of the legislature is the body that should be taking these for public input, because when it gets down to discussing programs and issues over which the YTG will have control and will be asked to change legislation, it's those people that sit in there as elected members who should be getting the input, and I'm sure we'll be getting input from all Yukoners before a decision is made.
I take it from that answer then that the YTG doesn't have a process that ensures the dissemination of the documents to people throughout the Yukon, and some mechanism that checks to make sure that those documents are not just sitting someplace, but are understood and are issues of discussion in communities.
No, we have no direct information program from the Land Claims Office that goes community to community to talk about these papers as they come from the Planning Council. After each Planning Council, when we have a paper released, we do have press conferences and that type of public dissemination of information. This sort of a thing is another method used, but there's no concentrated unit within the government assigned the responsibility of publicizing and disseminating Planning Council documents.
In light of that, our group felt that it would certainly be of benefit to the residents of the Yukon as a whole if the YTG undertook such a program. The next question that I have is one in relation to the issue of self-determination and responsible government. Mr. Joe, last week in his presentation, made abundantly clear that the central issue in the lands claims negotiation is an issue of self-determination. It would seem to me as though, and it seems to members of our group, that the issue of responsible government also has that as a principal issue for residents of the Yukon as a whole. How is it possible to arbitrarily separate the discussion of the lands claims with the discussions of the evolution of responsible government in the YTG?
Well, the evolution of responsible government is not tied to the land claim. We have come a long way thus far towards responsible government, mm-hmm. not tied to a land claim. The decision was made by the members of the Planning Council that constitutional development, the question of responsible government is an important one, but it should not be tied to a land claim. It should be attended separately but parallel. And this was accepted by the members of the Yukon Legislative Assembly and by the Minister of Indian and Northern Affairs, and indeed it's that process that is being discussed at this time. How indeed will such a process go on at the same time as land claims?
Well, it wasn't the point of process that our group was focusing on. It was the point of principle. While it was recognized you can carry on quite different types of negotiations or quite different processes, there are fundamental principles that are central to both of those. It may be conceivable in some instances that the issues in discussion in lands claim or issues under discussion in lands claim may be very similar to some of those that are under discussion in the YTG's discussions about the evolution of responsible government. To carry on those discussions separate from each other, does that mean that you are not considering what's happening in lands claims when you're discussing responsible government?
Bob, I'd like to interject a comment, and not speaking on anyone's behalf, but referring back to last week's program where we discussed the concept of self-determination. It's my own opinion that the panelists then, when they were discussing this question of government institutions in relation to self-determination, focused on community-level government rather than territory-wide government as the means of fulfilling obligations or for political institutions that were self-determining. And you know, maybe other people got a different interpretation from what was being said last week, but I think if you focus on community-level organization, you've got more of an opportunity of talking about meaningful government than you do if you discuss the constitutional development of the Yukon vis-a-vis Canada.
Would you...
Does that help?
Well, it still begs the question that I've asked initially. It seems as though the lands claims discussions cannot be divorced in principle, while they can be divorced in process from those of responsible government, albeit at the community level or at the regional level. Is there some mechanism established to ensure that the discussions about responsible government in the Yukon are consistent with those that are those discussions that are going on lands claim about lands claims?
Well, because the process hasn't been determined, I can't answer that properly, Bob, but you know, the Prime Minister himself intervened in the Northwest Territories because he feels the important nature of constitutional development in the North, and he could see that the whole process or the whole concept was getting totally bogged down because of the bickering and the fighting that was going on, and so thus he appointed a special representative to discuss with all groups in the North, including the Territorial Council of the Northwest Territories, the concept of constitutional development. And I would suspect that, to be consistent, some similar process would be developed here. In other words, it wouldn't be straight negotiation between the elected members of the Yukon Legislative Assembly and the Prime Minister or the Minister, that there will be a process that will involve Native groups, but indeed others as well, in this whole idea of constitutional development in the Yukon.
Thank you. Those are all the groups. Those are all the questions, I think, from our group. I might have missed some being covered by others. I encourage other members of our group to ask the questions if I have missed them.
Mr. Greiba, some of the few people in our group are wondering if you could tell us more about the working groups you were talking about. Who makes up the working groups, how many there are, and are there any working presently on the pipeline?
I think you want to address that question.
Okay.
Well, we'll spread it around, Ken. The working groups, first of all, I think you asked who are they made up of and how do they work. The working groups are, first of all, oriented at specific elements of the claim. There are working groups on eligibility, on education, on corporate structures, on corporate structures. Second, I have a list here, but in any event, all of these working groups are oriented at specific subject areas. They are formed by mutual decisions taken by the Planning Council. The Planning Council looks at an element and says, oh boy, there's a lot of interesting things that have to be explored here, research work and so on. Lands is another one. That's a rather important one. And each party in the Planning Council then provides a member for that working group, or members, depending on how many it's felt that are needed. The general direction for the conduct of the working group work comes from the Planning Council in writing. The working groups are not negotiating mediums. They are not legislating mediums. They are comprised primarily of specialists, some of whom are here in this room, as a matter of fact, representing the interests of the parties concerned. They do the research. They do the investigation of the issues that appear to be salient to the subject that they are addressing, and bring forward to the Planning Council on the basis of that the background work in some sort of comprehensively but concisely arranged order, along with recommendations on how the Planning Council might wish to resolve some of the issues. The Planning Council on the basis of that and any other direction that they may have, and discuss, debate the issues, and then come forward with a recommendation that's mutually acceptable. I think that it's safe to say that the working groups are really the sort of specialized research and support mechanism which each of the parties of the Planning Council has agreed is necessary they cannot operate unilaterally or without direction from the Planning Council, and so far I've had some very beneficial input to the Planning Council. I don't know if I've covered all your points. If I haven't, have at me.
There was a question about the working group on pipeline.
Oh, yeah. No, there is no specific working group on pipeline. As I mentioned before, somewhere during my presentation, the pipeline project is a very important and significant project. We are at the moment not in the position in Planning Council to have a working group on pipelines, nor do I think we will be, because there are other mechanisms whereby that will be handled. For example, I understand, and Ken can correct me if I'm wrong, Council for Yukon Indians have formed a specific body to attend to that. The federal government, as you know, has already done the same, and I believe the territorial government is taking certain measures as well. We don't want to get into a debate of the pros and cons of the pipeline, because in our view, that will be handled. Certainly all parties will be very aware of what their respective position and involvement with the pipeline project or any other project is. And if and when that becomes germane to the discussion in the Planning Council, I'm sure that the partners or the participants in the Planning Council will bring that point of view forward. But it, in effect, is a side issue, a very major side issue, but nonetheless a side issue to the pursuit of the claim.
Ken, do you want to come in?
I think since about July we've had a committee on the pipeline, and I really don't know what's happening too much with the committee, except that last week we met with Faulkner, and I think the week before that we met with Blair. But what goes on in that committee is something I don't know, because I don't belong to that committee. I know we have a pipeline committee. I'm not totally ignoring it. I think we did this because we kind of learned a little lesson that earlier, when all our efforts and everything was shifted to the pipeline, we lost a lot on negotiating, sitting down and negotiating. So what we've done now, I think, is come up with a committee just to deal with pipelines, not the whole organization dealing with it.
Supplementary, Mr. Chairman, I'll just list the working groups. I found it now. Eligibility, land, corporate structures, education, government structures, hunting, trapping, and fishing rights, but that working group has concentrated specifically on fishing so far. And in a second round, which, you know, discussions are going on, and we envisage groups on programs and taxation, resource revenue sharing, and monetary compensation as being other groups that will be formed within the foreseeable future.
Is that the only question?
Yeah.
Been covered by the other? Okay. Mr. Potter?
In the small group discussion that I dropped in on, there was some question as to whether or not the territorial government's input into the process was actually representative of probably the non-native community, and whether or not the elected XCOM member is representative is a question I'm not willing to get into or to hazard. But Mr. Commissioner, could you tell us where the territorial government's representatives or appointees or whatever to the working groups are drawn from? Are they drawn from the business community, from the legislative assembly, from within the public service, or where?
Up until this time, all the members on working groups that we have participated in, all of our representatives have been drawn from the public service of the government of the Yukon Territory. And they are resource people. The working groups are resource people to not discuss politics or policy, but to discuss in pragmatic and objective terms alternates and options for resolving any one of the issues at hand.
Anyone else in the audience?
One of the questions that came up in our group dealt with the whole concept of the Planning Council versus the notion of negotiations. We dealt quite a bit with skepticism and cynicism that was growing in the public. And what we would like to know is whether the two panel members that can speak for the negotiations or negotiating bodies feel that the Planning Council is going to be able to handle all the issues that are going to be raised, or in fact, are we going to be seeing some hard traditional negotiations going on in the future?
Gentlemen, anybody that wants to volley back first?
Well, I don't think it possible that all three participants in the Planning Council will agree on every issue of every element. And thus, your question does bring home the point that somewhere along the line there will be a negotiation. But I think what the planning process does, if it does anything at all, is to lay on the table all of the relevant facts so that the negotiation is not based on bluff, it's not based on non-logic. Everything is sitting there, and each group can then argue from fact and positions rather than the traditional concept of confrontation.
I think I would endorse the Commissioner's remarks fully. The whole object of the Planning Council process is to ensure that all of these facts and features are available to Planning Council members. Certainly, the federal view is that we may well do what amounts to negotiate in Planning Council, but there's a significant thing to remember here, and that is that the Planning Council will debate, negotiate, if you will, certain points, but nonetheless, they will then bring forward whatever it is that they have either agreed or disagreed upon to the respective executive levels. And it could well turn out that the Planning Council participants would get specific direction on the basis of those agreements or disagreements from their principals, their executive level, and come back again on an issue. So the element of negotiation will be woven into the process. But as the Commissioner clearly points out, if we have all of the facts well enough laid out and well enough researched, it may well be that it'll be more a tendency to common understanding and agreements rather than hard bargaining and head-on collisions and negotiations.
If I could just add a follow-up question to that. Who determines what is the factual information that is required? There seems to be, and certainly the Commissioner should know with scientific work, there's always a couple of sides to an issue that can be generated by having experts put things together. Is the intent to bring as much information to the table as possible so that you can have a broad perspective, or are you trying to get down to a mutually agreed to factual base that everyone accepts?
Wally, do you have available instructions to the working groups? The facts come from the working groups, and the parameters laid down for them are very general indeed, and instructions are to more or less put aside what the current situation is and start from scratch. Be practical. You have to recognize certain perspectives and certain realities. You've got to recognize, for example, the mix of native and non-native people in the territory in considering something. You've got to recognize what has gone on in the past. But we don't have to adopt carte blanche the standards that currently exist. The working group can start at a base below that and bring forward what we want are options. We don't want them to make the decision. That's not their mandate. Their mandate is to bring forward options, to bring forward information, and then hopefully at the Planning Council, at the political level, a decision can be made.
Yes, I'd like to add to that. That's essentially the federal perspective on working groups. I think that to answer your question concerning who decides what the working groups should look at and how, the Planning Council does that. You have to bear in mind that the Planning Council does represent the respective views of the participants, And so by the time that they're identifying an element and talking about aspects of that element, they have a pretty comprehensive knowledge of what that element involves. And then jointly, in the decision to form a working group, they form, as the commissioner has pointed out, a set of instructions which are quite broad. I can think of one or two issues already without becoming specific, which I can't at the present time, but there have been two or three issues where we know what is, and we know what might have been. What we'd like to know in Planning Council is what are some of the options to do something perhaps a little differently. And in those cases, the working groups were told, well, sure, record what is, and we know what might have been, but start with a clean page. You have a goal put before you, we'll say to the working group, what the Indian people might want to do concerning a particular element. So pursue that. See what ways there might be of achieving that goal. Some of those ways may be the ones that now exist. There may be something that has not yet been thought of that would be better. And that's what we want to see at Planning Council.
Linda?
Just to continue with working groups for a moment, I wonder, Mr. Greiber, can you tell us who is on the Government Structures Working Group, and what does government structures mean in the context of a working group?
In response to the first part, there at the moment, I don't think I'm prepared to enter into discussions of names, but there's representation of the three parties. The reason I don't want to get into discussion of names is that names change from time to time, and for one thing, and for second reason is that I think there is that element of ensuring that working group participants have some degree of anonymity in terms of representations that people might make to them. Which would hamper their activities. I have no reason other than that. It's not a matter of not having confidence in working group participants, but I think if we started listing the names of everybody that's been involved with a particular working group, we might have to have a two-volume book. There are people who play lead roles from time to time, but I, for example, couldn't tell you who on the federal side all was involved. There have been a number of people consulted, so I could give you a list which would mean nothing. You know, somebody contributed a paragraph, somebody contributed a volume, for all I know. But your second part of your question was, again?
Was what does government structures mean in the context of that working?
Government structures, government structures is primarily oriented towards those structures which, putting aside for the moment the constitutional development question, which is an important one but not being discussed at the table, things like, for example, we talk about the provision of certain lands to the Indian people under certain circumstances. There would be a management body or management bodies, for example, that would be responsible, game management, various sorts of organs that would be required to fulfill whatever requirements the Indian people may have in terms of wanting some control and participation, and of course recognize the legitimate desire of the rest of the Yukoners to also participate. It could well be local forms of government. For example, I'm sure, although the working group so far hasn't gone into it that deeply, we know that, for example, there are LIDs and there are band councils which exist in the same community. Now the CYI has formed a version of a local government body called community councils. We would hope that a working group could have a look at that which is, and say, well, will this work out or won't it? Or what could be changed to maybe assist in better participation of one segment or another of the community? We, as the Commissioner pointed out, are not debating constitutional development at the Planning Council table. Very much aware of that, and aware that certain measures and steps will be taken. And we'll be aware of them because we're all three at the table. So whatever input is required will be made. But the local government, or the government structures working group, addresses the widest possible range of things. How does one participate? How does one ensure that there's a proportional and a representative voice in everything from local community councils through various regulatory bodies, perhaps policy input, who knows? It's a very wide-ranging subject.
I guess, do I read that then, that that's wide-ranging, exclusive of constitutional development?
I wouldn't characterize the Planning Council as ignoring that there would be constitutional development discussions going on. I'm just simply saying that those discussions will not be going on within the Planning Council, because the territorial government, because the federal government and the Indian people are at the table in Planning Council, each of them being very aware of what is transpiring in the discussion of constitutional development. Obviously, there will be an awareness at the Planning Council table. But we have no intention of, in Planning Council, trying to determine the constitutional development future of the Yukon.
Anybody else? Ted Parnell?
Supplementary. How long do we have to wait before we know who the members of various committees, working groups are? Is this going to be secret forever, or do we at some point know who is representing us in these working groups? Or not representing us, but who is providing the input, which is a very important part of this whole process. The information that goes in is going to absolutely affect what comes out in the way of a settlement.
Well, I don't think you're going to see a publication of a list of names. Here are the participants in working groups. I feel quite confident in telling you, for example, that the federal participant in the eligibility working group is a person by the name of Wendy McBride from Ottawa. Now, if that means something, I guess that, you know, who Wendy is who Wendy is a person who has particular knowledge of the subject. And she consults with a chap, maybe you've heard his name, Harry Chapman, who is the registrar for the Department of Indian Affairs. I don't know if that means anything to you, but you can see what you get into. What I'm saying is that there are the people who are participants in working groups are will be and are those people who have a particular knowledge of a subject area. They may be one name today and three names tomorrow and no names the next day. It'd be a little bit fruitless to pursue it any further than that, I think.
Ted Parnell?
Yes, discussion group in 114 wanted to pose four questions, and one of them on working groups has been massaged fairly well, so I think I'll let that one pass. The of the remaining three, the first one was, how do the three parties at the negotiating table feel about the role of YTG in the negotiations? And we realize there are many different ways that question can be taken, and please feel free to take it as many ways as you'd like, to all of the panel members.
Art, would you like to begin or end responding to that?
I think our position is pretty clear. We think it absolutely essential and necessary for consummation of a claim that will be meaningful for the future of the Yukon that the YTG represent the views of Yukoners in general at that table. And without that, we feel there would be little chance of general acceptability of many of the issues that are of very great importance to the Indian people, and that's why we're there.
I think it's clear that the federal government views it to be quite important that the point of view of those Yukoners who are not Indian people be represented. And the Minister of Indian Affairs and Northern Development on behalf of Canada has so indicated, and in fact has asked that the Commissioner and whomever he may choose would represent the Yukon Territorial Government at the Planning Council table. We, I think, feel that notwithstanding any legalities as to who signs a document or who doesn't, the point of view of the people of the Yukon, whoever they may be, must be clearly represented at the Planning Council table. And in that context, we view the participation of not only appointed but elected members of the Yukon Territorial Government as an important contribution.
Even though I can't speak for CY negotiating table, I guess what I can say, though, is that I guess we're realistic enough to realize that after settlement is reached, that all the non-Indians in the Yukon are not going to split, and that there's going to be a government here, and there's going to be non-Indians here. So I think for this reason that we've agreed to YTG participating, because we believe that we have to figure out or settle a way where we can live together as people up here. I guess this is a start at the negotiating table, planning process.
Thank you. The second question is, what is the YTG doing to ensure that non-Native people can receive benefits as well?
Well, I'm not sure what sort of benefit you have in mind from a Yukon Indian land claim. Perhaps you can elaborate a little.
The things that were brought up in the group discussion related to such things as land, opportunities for economic development, opportunities for increased participation in local government and decentralized government, things of that sort.
Well, those issues are not really part of a land claim in terms of the YTG trying to establish a position for the non-natives in that context.
Yes, I think our group realizes that. I think what the intent of the question was is YTG doing anything outside of the land claim process to try and make sure that there are other benefits for non-native Yukoners?
You're asking, in effect, for the administrative, legislative, and legal programs of YTG in detail, then?
I don't think the group wanted them in detail, no.
In summary, then.
Well, that's ranging a little far afield from the purpose that we are here today, I think, but you follow the activities in the Legislative Assembly, and you know the issues at hand at the present time. Block transfer of land so that we can orderly develop communities, control over recreational lands so that we can develop a policy at the local level that will respond to the people of the territory. These things are ongoing on a daily basis in discussions between the territorial government and the federal government. But let's make it clear, they're not discussed at the Planning Council. That's not part of the process that we're talking about here today.
Okay, if there are any other aspects of that question I missed, I'll let the other group members follow it up. The remaining question was, how do the three parties view the concept of one government? This concept came up, and nobody really knew what it meant, and they didn't really have much of an idea of how the three parties, what interpretation they put on it, and how they viewed it.
Wally, you want to lead off on it?
Yeah, I think the significance is in the word one government, or the hyphenated word one government structure. There's no question that Canada, being made up of the constituent parts, namely provinces under various legislations, and various territories, two territories under legislation, functions on the basis that that there will be a central government at the federal level, and that there will be a central government, if you will, at the regional or provincial level. I think in Planning Council it was recognized very early that, as Mr. Kane has pointed out, the people of the Yukon, whoever they may be, will be here for many centuries to come, no doubt. And it would not be appropriate or desirable to attempt to establish some sort of fragmented, overlapping, frequently misunderstood conglomeration of jurisdictions. And no one appeared to, and nor does anyone now, contemplate that as a viable way of doing things. So the Planning Council agreed that one government structure would be the desirable way to go, which simply means that whether it be territorial or ultimately, whenever that comes about, provincial government, for the common good, there would be a one government structure, hopefully that was representative of the needs and the desires of the people who constitute that government. Within that, though, there is recognition that for certain purposes, there may be some new ways of doing things. And that's where such things as bodies that, regulatory bodies, advisory bodies, controlling bodies for that matter, of various kinds, may well be comprised slightly differently than one would ordinarily think they would be. For example, the Indian people on lands over which they have, of which they have exclusive ownership, may very well want to have some sort of a structure that is particular to that. To the management and administration of those lands. But that doesn't mean that that's any different than having a particular structure in some other corporate body that looks after the interests of its members. It simply means that there wouldn't be two Yukon legislatures or two Yukon provincial governments or whatever. There would be one government. And in that government, there would be representation of the Indian people's interests and those who aren't Indian people. Hopefully on a proportional and a rational basis.
Art, would you like to add anything to that?
I don't really think there's much to add. One government as opposed to two governments or three governments or four governments. One government meaning an agency that will represent all of the people. And we are, I think, very firm and very unanimous at the Planning Council that we do not want to see partitioning and separate entities exist in the Yukon that will represent racial groups. We feel that we have to start from the basis that we will work together, we can work together, we have common goals, and the only way to go is together, not separate entities.
Ken, would you care to comment?
like I said recently, we're realistic enough that after settlements reach, I guess we're talking about government control or government control. One where our people have discussed it is local control that we're talking about. We already have some local control, government control through the bands, municipal type governments already in place. But I think the thing that we're thinking about is first of all, trying to figure out how. I think we're leaving it open to the other people at the table, I believe, to come up with alternatives, ways of governing ourselves as people up here. And we're leaving ourselves open to that point, too. Because, like I say, right now, a lot of our people, this is something new to them, and we're just grasping like municipal type band controls now. And this one government control, I think, is right now is what we're looking at. And we're going to be open and, like we said, all those working groups and everything. Because we certainly do want to cooperate. And like the other people said here, like Mr. Greibo was saying, in the Yukon here, we have an opportunity to come up with something different, an alternative way of governing ourselves as people.
That's all I have. Is there anything further? Mr. Armstrong?
I think there's one thing that's been overlooked by a lot of people, and that is they don't realize that the Trudeau government has given Indian people an opportunity to participate in the development of the Yukon I know quite a number of Indian people are interested in gardening and cattle ranching, and there are some lands that are suitable for such activities, but a lot of it is submarginal to marginal land, and it needs considerable improvement before it would be an economic project. And as I see it, all the Indian people have to do is to ask for the privilege of investing your time in development of these lands, and at the same time draw welfare or unemployment insurance benefits, as long as the government retains the ownership of this land. And that way the government will have control, and we'll be getting something done that will improve the country, so when somebody wants to lease that land, it'll be productive. The way it is, a lot of the land as it is not productive. And I think that the Trudeau government has already set up all that's needed in the form of the Canada Industrial Development Corporation scheme. If the Indians haven't got brains enough to make use of that scheme, they deserve to starve to death.
Any further questions? One last question.
I have a question for Ken. I'm still getting back to the idea of non-native input from the Yukon into the process. And I'm wondering, although I know you're not directly involved with the negotiating, if you can recall any instance when the three parties met, when the point of view of the territorial government and the point of view of the federal government differed. Was there any instance where there was not agreement between those two parties when you sat down to the table?
That's pretty hard for me to answer, because like I said, I work in communications, and I have nothing to do with anybody sitting down at the table. I think Art and Mr. Greiber might answer that better.
I'm not sure whether either of you two gentlemen can comment on that. I'm sure that there